From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Zaytoun. Today, a personal story of a national tragedy. 5 years ago, Hurricane Katrina struck New Orleans. Abdurrahman Zaytoun, a Syrian-born New Orleans building contractor, stayed in the city while his wife, Kathy, and children left for Baton Rouge. He paddled the flooded streets in his canoe and helped rescue many of his stranded neighbors. Days later, armed police and National Guardsmen arrested him and accused him of being a terrorist. He was held for nearly a month, most of which he was not allowed to call his wife, Kathy. Today, in a rare broadcast interview, Abdurrahman and Kathy Zaytoun join us to tell their story, along with the man who chronicled it in his book, Zaytoun, Dave Eggers, who just won the book award for Zaytoun. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations says the flooding in Pakistan has displaced an additional 1 million people in the last 2 days. The warning comes as hundreds of thousands of people are being evacuated from the southern city of Fatah. At the United Nations, Emergency Relief Coordinator John Holmes said the flooding has significantly affected over 17 million people. The UN says some 8 million people are in need of emergency aid. Aid officials, meanwhile, are warning they're coming under threat from the Taliban and other militant groups. In Washington, State Department spokesperson P.J. Crowley said the U.S. is monitoring the alleged threats. The Washington Post is reporting the CIA has made regular payments to a number of top officials in the Afghan government. Some have been used as informants, while others have been paid to ensure access for U.S. officials. The payments have continued despite concerns the U.S. is backing the Afghan government corruption it's claimed to oppose. According to the New York Times, one of the officials is Mohammed Zia Salehi, who was arrested on bribery charges last month. The UN Security Council's calling for increased measures to prevent a repeat of the recent mass rapes of almost 200 women and 5 young boys in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Rwandan and Congolese rebels carried out the rapes between July 30th and August 3rd, within miles of a UN peacekeeping base. The UN was notified days later, but waited 3 weeks to respond. The top UN envoy to the Democratic Republic of Congo, Robert Meese, visited the area on Thursday. A U.S. citizen is on his way back to the United States after 8 months in prison in North Korea. Aijalan Mahli Gomez was freed today after former President Jimmy Carter traveled to North Korea to win his release. Gomez was imprisoned in January after North Korea claimed he unlawfully crossed over from China. Carter's visit came as North Korean leader Kim Jong-il traveled to China. There's been speculation Kim is seeking to win Chinese support for a transfer of power to his son, Kim Jong-un. New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson says he's made progress in talks with Cuban officials on releasing a jailed U.S. contractor. The contractor, Alan Gross, was arrested in December on suspicion of being a U.S. spy after handing out equipment to Cuban opposition groups. Speaking in Havana, Richardson rejected linking Gross's case to the jailing of the Cuban Five, who are serving lengthy sentences in the U.S. for trying to monitor violent right-wing Cuban exile groups responsible for attacks inside Cuba.
The Obama administration asked me to raise at the highest levels the case of Alan Gross, and I've done so with several officials. I've been informed by the Cuban government that the Gross case is at a very sensitive investigatory and legal process. And I do believe, as I want to emphasize, that I've made inroads on this case. I believe that the two cases of the Cuban Five and the Gross case are separate, and I believe both countries are treating them separately.
South Africa's main labor union is threatening to widen a nationwide state workers' strike in a campaign for increased wages. Over a million workers have already walked off the job this month. On Thursday, the head of the Congress of South African Trade Unions, Zwelinzima Vavi, said all 2 million union members could soon take part.
In 7 days, the whole of this economy will stand still. The wheels in the mining industry that turns for gold to come up into surface and diamond and coal will come to a stop. Everything will come to a standstill.
An Israeli military court has convicted a prominent Palestinian activist who heads a group opposing Israel's separation wall through the West Bank. Abdallah Abu Rama of the Bilin Popular Committee Against the Wall faces sentencing on multiple charges, including incitement. Abu Rama's attorney, Gabby Lasky, said the Israeli military is trying to silence nonviolent protest.
Regretfully, I don't believe that there are high chances of changing this conviction, since, as I've said, the use of the court in this matter has been a political use, illegitimate use, and we have to remember that these are the courts of the occupier being used against the occupied.
In a statement this week, the European Union condemned Abu Rama's conviction, calling him, quote, a human rights defender whose prosecution could be used to prevent him and other Palestinians from exercising their legitimate right to protest, they said. The New York City taxi driver stabbed by a drunken passenger in an anti-Muslim attack has spoken out publicly for the first time. The victim is Ahmed Sharif. He was slashed across his face, neck and hands after the suspect, Michael Enright, determined Sharif is a Muslim. Speaking Thursday at City Hall, Sharif described the moment his neck was slashed.
I see the knife was in front of my throat. And I go a little bit back, this came right over there. If this one is can put it here, I'm not supposed to be talk right now, I'm dead. So when the attack come from the back, it was a shock. I'm still scared. I mean, still I have a view of the knife when I close my eye.
The attack on Sharif came amidst the ongoing hysteria over a proposed Islamic cultural center near New York's Ground Zero. Enright faces multiple charges, including felony attempted murder as a hate crime. He's being held without bail. Aliyah Latif of the Council on American-Islamic Relations said Enright should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law.
Indeed, crimes motivated by racial and religious hatred implicate entire communities, and as such, demand our utmost attention. To that end, Mr. Sharif's case should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law to serve as both a legal deterrent and public repudiation of violent bigotry.
Enright was embedded with troops in Afghanistan, making a documentary about them. More reports continue to emerge of anti-Muslim acts. The Council on American-Islamic Relations says a man entered a mosque in Queens Wednesday night and shouted anti-Muslim slurs as he urinated on prayer rugs. The Obama administration's backing the effort of major utility companies to dismiss a case seeking to impose curbs on emissions of greenhouse gases. A group of plaintiffs, including 8 state governments and the city of New York, has filed suit seeking to force the Tennessee Valley Authority and 5 other utilities to reduce their emissions each year for a decade. On Thursday, the Justice Department said the case is unnecessary because the Environmental Protection Agency has sought to limit emissions. But environmentalists criticized the move because the curbs have only been proposed, not enacted. In West Virginia, 2 protesters opposed to anti-mountaintop removal mining were arrested Thursday after blocking an entrance to the State Department of Environmental Protection in Charleston. The activists had chained themselves to a barrel with the slogan, Department of Easy Permits. Both are members of the group Climate Ground Zero. And the charity of Microsoft founder Bill Gates and his wife Melinda is under criticism following the disclosure. It substantially increased its holdings in the agribusiness giant Monsanto to over $23 million. Critics say the investment in Monsanto contradicts the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's stated commitment to helping farmers and sustainable development in Africa. In 2007, the Gates Foundation said it would review its holdings after a lengthy expose in the Los Angeles Times revealed it had invested nearly $9 billion in companies whose practices run counter to the foundation's charitable goals. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. It was 5 years ago that Hurricane Katrina was barreling towards the Gulf Coast. Today, a Democracy Now! Global broadcast exclusive. We spend the hour on the story of one family from New Orleans, the Zaytouns. Not only experienced the widespread displacement caused by the storm, but they were also victimized by the so-called War on Terror. Their story forms the basis of the critically acclaimed novel Zaytoun by the celebrated writer Dave Eggers, who just won the American Book Award for his book. Abdulrahman Zaytoun is a Syrian-born immigrant to the United States who lived in New Orleans with his wife, Kathy, an American convert to Islam, and their children. Together, they ran a successful painting and contracting business and are well-known in the local community of New Orleans. As a storm approached the city in late August 2005, Kathy and her kids fled to Baton Rouge, to her sister's house. They then proceeded to a friend's home in Phoenix, Arizona, where they waited out the storm. Meanwhile, Abdulrahman Zaytoun was ready with a 16-foot aluminum canoe when Katrina made landfall as a Category 3 storm on August 29th. The book tells the story of how Zaytoun spent days rescuing people stranded in the storm until he was picked up by an armed squad who accused him of being a terrorist. He was held for 3 weeks without any contact with his family. They thought he was dead. In an exclusive broadcast interview, I spoke with Abdulrahman Zaytoun and his wife, Kathy, yesterday, as well as the best-selling writer-publisher Dave Eggers, whose numerous works include A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius, also the founder of the independent publishing house and literary journal McSweeney's. I began the interview by asking Dave Eggers to explain how he first came across the story of what the Zaytouns went through in the aftermath of Katrina.
At McSweeney's, we have a small publishing company in San Francisco, and we have a series called Voice of Witness that uses oral history to illuminate human rights crises around the world. And the first book in the series was about the wrongfully convicted and exonerated here in the U.S., and right when that book was coming out, Katrina hit. And so we talked to a lot of friends that we had in Houston, Baton Rouge, New Orleans, Atlanta, and people fanned out and began interviewing New Orleanians who had fled the storm. And when we started getting the transcripts back and the tapes back from the interviewers, I saw the story of the Zaytouns, and I was struck by it on so many levels. And so the next time I was in New Orleans a few months later, I met the family, and we spent many hours together, and I got to know the kids. And I think even, you know, I was struck by it on the level of, you know, I don't think many of us knew of this intersection, this improbable intersection of the War on Terror and Katrina, and how the folding of FEMA into Homeland Security affected the response to Katrina. And there were so many sort of political aspects of it, and I was interested in on a journalistic level. But it was also getting to know this family that I connected to almost immediately. And also, you know, their story goes so deep. And, you know, and I, Zaytoun's family's story in Syria was so fascinating. And Kathy's conversion to Islam was, I think, a really valuable way to introduce Islam to readers that might not know too much about it. And so they're this all-American family that they encompass the immigrant experience, the American dream, the all of these all-American values in New Orleans, and then at the same time, you know, he was put in this moment in time where he rose to a challenge and became a hero, and then of course something terrible happened that I hope could never happen again in this country, that it was this a moment in time when we didn't live up to our highest values and aspirations. And so there were so many aspects of it that interested me. And but again, most of it was a personal connection to the family that, you know, now it's 5 years on and we're inextricably woven together and very close. And so it was their faith in me and their trust in me and their courage in telling their story that made it possible.
Dave Eggers, could you tell us a little bit of what you just told us in shorthand? Where Zaytoun, where Abdurrahman Zaytoun was born, how he grew up, how he ended up here, and then went from the horror of the storm to the horror of the prison after being considered a hero?
Well, you know, some of one of the great parts of researching a book like this was to go back to his hometown of Jable on the coast of Syria and see this, what was at the time when he was growing up, a pretty small fishing village. And it's grown somewhat since then. But I was able to meet his brothers and sisters, all of whom, or most of whom, are still there, and also see their his grandmother's hometown, which is on an island called Arwad Island, which is just off the coast to near Tartus, and get to know everybody and see, you know, and get to know generations of the Zaytouns. And it's an incredibly illustrious family that has, you know, they've achieved so so many things. You know, they're professors and they're principals of schools and doctors, and you know, his brother Ahmed is a ship captain, and I got to spend time with him in Spain. And so Zaytoun grew up there, and he eventually became a merchant sailor, sailing around the world on many different vessels, helping to load and unload, and he saw the world that way, and finally stopped in the U.S. He first settled in Baton Rouge and then New Orleans, and he built this business from scratch because he had grown up around a lot of different trades, and he got to know masonry and painting and carpentry, and he was, you know, he worked for a lot of other contractors, and he was the hardest working guy that they'd ever seen. And so pretty soon he had his own business. Soon after, he married Kathy, and they built this business together as, like, equal partners and, you know, handling different sides of the business. And so in every way, they really do embody the American dream: hard work, family, and a dedication to one's neighbors. You could see how one of the reasons that he stayed behind when the storm hit was to take care of his clients' homes. He felt he has keys to every one of them. He's got, you know, hundreds of keys to homes all over the city because he's taken care of these houses. And so, and everybody trusts him with them. So, which makes it all the more tragic, I think, and exasperating that he's the model citizen in so many ways, and he was victimized this way.
Talk about that day, September 6th, and the different men who, Zaytoun had been going around with, helping others with. Talk about Nasser and Todd, and from your research, what happened that day?
Well, Nasser was a friend of Zaytoun's, who also was Syrian, and they'd gone back. They knew each other for many, many years, and he had been living in the city as first came here as a graduate student at Tulane, and they ran into each other after the storm, and Nasser helped distribute supplies with Zaytoun in the canoe, and they spent many days together, and Nasser was living at that house on Claiborne, too. And then Todd Gambino is a resident there, and he, you know, a whole book could be written about Todd because he saved many, many lives. And going around on a motorboat, and then there was this relative stranger named Ronnie that none of them knew, but who had stopped by once or twice to use the phone. And you know, after all of this happened, I was sure I got a copy of the arrest record, and I wanted to see who the officers were on the arrest record. There were two there, and so I tracked down both of them. One of whom was a veteran officer from New Mexico, who had come to the New Orleans after the storm, and then the main officer was a New Orleans police officer who had been going around up and down Claiborne and had been He says that in my interview with him, he said that he observed them looting, all four of them looting a Walgreens. In the end, there was no evidence of any looting. He didn't recover any stolen goods at the house or anything like that. And so, he went to Napoleon St. Charles, where many military and other officers and were gathered, and he got a team together, and then they came into the house and raided it and arrested all four of them. And so, I found it totally important to interview these two officers, and I think, you know, had the whole system been working, had there been due process, had there been public defenders available and rational bail set and phone calls available to people and people being able to be visited by or contact their relatives or family, and had any of these other things that we take for granted been in place, a lot of these the injustices would have been mitigated to some extent. But none of these were none of these systems were working. And so once they were arrested and brought, as you know, in this van driven by a National Guardsman, brought to Camp Greyhound, they got lost in the system. That's when the system was broken down. And even if the arrest had been wrongful and the evidence wasn't there, and under normal circumstances, they would have been free on bail and the charges would have been dropped momentarily. But in this case, because none of these other systems were working, that's how they and hundreds of others were lost in the Louisiana prison system. And, you know, Todd Gambino did many months in prison. Nasser did many months in prison. And hundreds of others did what was known as Katrina time, where they were lost in the system. Records weren't kept. Some people weren't allowed to make phone calls or meet with lawyers or anyone for upwards of a year. And so it was a complete meltdown of the system, unfortunately.
Dave Eggers has just won the American Book Award for his book, Zaytoun. He's joining us from New Orleans. We're going to come back to Dave, but before we do, we're going to hear from the Zaytouns themselves in their own words. Stay with us. Women fought their lives down in New Orleans. Can't afford a gallon of gasoline. With your useless degrees and your contrary. Black Rain by Ben Harper in this Democracy Now! Global broadcast exclusive. The first time Dave Eggers and the subjects of his book, The Zaytouns, have joined together in a studio to tell their story. It's the fifth anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. And we go to the Rahmans, to Abdulrahman and Kathy Zaytoun themselves. Abdulrahman is known in New Orleans by his last name, Zaytoun. I spoke to Zaytoun and his wife, Kathy, yesterday. Describe the day that life as you know it completely changed. Of course, life had already changed. You were alone there trying to help people, your family in Baton Rouge.
This day, we come from around noon, like maybe around 3 o'clock. And I got to the house, and I go to the bathroom, and I open the water, and I see the water running. You know, for 1 week, you don't see water running. And I jump, take a shower right away, and I have the couple of guys. The one guy I brought with me from other place, and I tell him, go ahead, jump in the shower because I have water running. And I got outside and start making my phone calls, and he got out, and someone start talking to him. I can see who talking while I hear just somebody talking. I say, who's outside? He said, someone asked us if we need any water. I said, tell him we have enough, and maybe somebody else needed more than us. And this guy, I mean, he uses the way, if you need water, to keep coming to the house. And the guys keep talking and come closer slowly to the house, and I feel 5-6 guys, military, with the policeman, jump in the house with all weapon. And the guys asked us, what you guys doing here? I said, it's my house. He says, you have ID? I said, yes. I showed him my ID. I know, I think he have enough time to see, to read my name. He just saw some aperture and like sees a strange name, and he say, go ahead to the boat. And the table in the middle of the room, I have my note in it with my wife, where she's staying, phone numbers. Only way in touch with her, other way I can't touch with her, because the cell phone doesn't work. I can ask him if I can get the note. He said, no, just go on the boat. And I tried to get it anyway, and he preparing to shoot. And I said, okay, this is not good. And I got to the boat, and I have other two guys there also. Say, all of you get on the boat. And happened that Gambino, he's outside coming from somewhere. And as I get that, he asked, what's going on? He said, who are you? He said, I live here. He said, get in the boat. And they brought him with us. And
their guns are drawn?
Yes, they have, ready to shoot. You know, they have all, like, military, like, ready. Like, this guy's coming for prepare for war. And brought us to St. Charles and Napoleon. Soon we got there, we have, like, every one of us being 5-6 guys jumping him and tied him down. And I saw something like only thing you see it in the movies. Anyway,
but they jump on each one of you and tie you down.
Yes, ma'am. I mean, I don't know what happens in this guy's mind. I feel something not good. And after we brought us to the van. Before that, we were in the boat. I said, when are you taking us? He said, we take you to talk to our boss. When we got there and see this motion, action, when we in the van waiting, I have one guy come behind the wheel, and I ask him, what's going on? What's wrong? He said, we from Indiana, we're doing our job. So only thing he have to say. And I stay quiet almost like for 15 minutes. We sit and waiting. After that, he got the order to move. He brought us to the bus station there. And
the Greyhound station.
Yes, the Greyhound station. And we stay almost like an hour in the lobby there, where, and taking pictures and checking us and strip us naked. And now, done all that kind of. And have guys around us, like with the dog and sitting like security. Very, very high security, I don't know how to describe it. It was just very, we can't move. We have to stay in our leg open and have foot in place, and our arm in the seat. I mean, any movement. And after we finish, brought us to the, where the bus line up have like designed like Guantanamo Bay jails, like wire and like fence wires, and almost like I think 15, 20 foot high. And we have like gauges. Brought us ourselves with one of the gauges. First gauge next to the station, next to the engine for the train. We stay next to the engine for 3 days. Running our ears. I mean, I think I become deaf after that, because imagine you'll be 3 days next to the engine run, because the engine generates electricity for the station.
Zaytoun, just to understand here, you had been looking for help to save your neighbors over these days that you were saving people. Now you were brought to the Greyhound station, and you say it was built like Guantanamo, which means they must have been spending time since the storm turning this bus station into a prison. You'd been traveling a lot in your canoe. Had you seen this happening?
No, because I never got this close to the bus station. What I saw over there have not just, spend some time. You have all kind of very high-tech equipment there. Have lifters, crane. Have a machine with big wheels to prepare to drive in the water. I mean, very high-tech equipment there, and this kind of be used to rescue people. Better to build a jail. I mean, I surprised and have also all kind of machineries. You can imagine this there.
Why did they tell you you had been arrested, you had been detained, that you were stripped naked, that you were being imprisoned with the other men that you'd been traveling around with to help others? What was your crime, did they say?
This is why I try to find out. Every time we ask someone and they start to throw a name in us, your guy's Taliban, your Al-Qaeda, I mean, each one guy's passing by, give us, like, I know he's like, he throw it like a joke or like a serious. We don't know what this, Allah, you know, been telling us like that. And
now said you were Taliban and Al Qaeda.
Yes, this is what they're accusing us for first, and this is why when first day in we in the bus station, these people called what you call it the Homeland Security in us. And have two guys come there and interview us inside. And this guy, like, check his head, and he left. He said, we don't have nothing with these people, you know, just left. And that's why this guy think he have, like, when brought us from there, have a big fish. And I don't know what this guy thinking. And also, after we after 3 days, we've been transferred to Baton Rouge. Also, I have to, after like a week from being transferred to Baton Rouge, we have FBI or some high official guys, very, very, very intelligent people come to us and interview me and other my friend. And he tell me like that. He said, look, we don't have nothing in you. We never have anything in you. Just up to these people, you know, what you got to do. And he asked me what I can do to help you. And I request for him to call my wife that I'm okay. And he did, you know. And the people in jail in Baton Rouge, anyway, in New Orleans too, nobody gave us chance to call or just to pass message to my wife to say, I'm here or I'm alive. Every time I ask somebody, please call my wife, he said, we can't do that. Let me make phone call. We can't let you do that. And happened almost like 3 weeks. I never have chance to call my wife, let her know where I am.
Kathy Zaytoun, talk about this time from September 6th, when you stopped hearing from your husband for these weeks. Where were you when the call stopped, and what happened to you and your kids afterwards?
At this time, we were in Arizona, Chandler, Arizona. I kept waiting for him to call. He didn't. Every time the phone would ring, I would rush to the phone, hoping that it was him. It wasn't. By the next day, we didn't hear from him. Then we went to the Red Cross building, and then we put in a missing persons report. And also, we put our name over at—I think they have a Coliseum over there. We had to go there and file a missing persons report over there as well. And his brother, at this point, was calling, asking if I had heard from him, because he could no longer get in touch with him as well. So then we had his brother and then the rest of his family calling because they couldn't get in touch with him as well, and everybody was worried about him at this point.
And so at what point did you start to give up hope, and what were you telling your children?
I think by the second week, I was really horribly nervous. And I would just tell my children when I saw that it was affecting them so horribly at this point, I was telling them, they would hear me speak with my sister, and it was affecting, especially my youngest daughter. It affected her horribly. I mean, she stopped eating. She wasn't sleeping very well. Her hair was falling out when I would brush it. You would hear her talking to her cousin. She would say, we have so much water in our house and so much of the street, and we don't know where my dad is. So finally, when I saw that my emotions are playing on my children, then we just had to tell them, no, I heard from Daddy. Daddy's with a friend. He's going to be home soon. But maybe they believed it, maybe not. It didn't settle her nerves any. So it was a really bad time for all of us.
You were a well-known developer in New Orleans. How is it that no one knew you? From all the houses you'd built and rebuilt and rented, who were these people who were holding you?
This all of them not from our town. I think most of them come from what's called Angola. What I heard, and other people, military people from Indiana. That's what he tell me.
Angola, so meaning Indiana, the prison in Angola, Louisiana.
Angola prison. Yeah, this is what I heard this, the people around the prison and in New Orleans from Angola prison, and also the most of the military, the one pick me up from the guy tell me we from Indiana. This is what he said, we do from Indiana, we do our job. I don't think anybody from our city around.
Talk about the man, the old African-American missionary who is giving out Bibles at the Hunt prison, who finally you got to make the critical call to Kathy.
Believe it or not, anybody pass by me, I will, you know, try to just encourage him to make this phone call, not just him. I have everybody, including, you know, the lady, she disturbed the medicine for the people with the prescription or the, and also I have one lady security. I say, well, man, this lady maybe have softer heart from the guys. Let her try this. I try and say, no, I can't. I say, I don't want you to, and just call my wife and tell her I'm here, I'm live. That's it. He say, I can't do it. And I'm talking about we in Baton Rouge. And I know, I heard people making calls from there. Just for us, he say, the phone broken. Never let us, you know, every time we call for phone, after 3 weeks, give us chance to make phone call. And where I go to make the call, and because only number I have, my wife's cell phone, I don't know where the number she's staying, the land phone, I don't know, I have the number, because I left it in the table in the house where I used to be. And he gave me one chance to make phone call, and we can't call cell phone, we have to be land phone. And come back with empty-handed.
But this man did make the call to Kathy.
No, this man, this man, when he passed by, and, you know, I just, this guy, you know, giving religious advice and things. And I asked him if he can do this call for me. He said, okay, and he writes the number. And I mean, I'm trying everybody. I mean, I give up. I keep trying. And he did. And days later, when the government official come and interview us, and he asked me if I need any help. Well, even I don't want him to take me out. I don't ask him to get me outside. I just said, go call my wife. I mean, if he wanted to take me out, I'm sure he can, because this is, you know, one from high position officer. And all I ask him, just because I know if I get out, nothing to do. All I need is to my wife to know I'm safe.
What, Kathy, when you got that call, what did it mean to you, and how did you begin to track down your husband? You didn't know where he was.
No, I didn't know where he was at the time. When I got the phone call, it was a big relief. I didn't want to let the man off the telephone, to be honest. I tried to hold him as much as I can, ask him as many questions as I could. But in reality, I think we were only on the phone for like a few minutes. And he told me, don't worry, everything's going to work itself out, and most likely the charges are going to be dropped. But not too long after that, I think Homeland Security called me as well and told me, look, your husband is here. Don't worry, the charges are going to be dropped. We have no interest in him. We've never had any interest in him. And don't worry, everything's going to be fine soon. You know, just all the charges are going to be dropped. Don't worry, he's here. As soon as I found out where he was, I called the lawyer, Raleigh Allmeyer, and we started trying to track him down. You know, it was really hard to track him down, even though we knew where he was, because I didn't have the names of the people in a computer. It was just on a piece of paper on the side of a desk or in a file. It wasn't, when I would call the prison and try to find out what kind of rights I would have, they'd say he's not our prisoner. So I guess because he wasn't their prisoner, FEMA was paying them to keep him there. He did not have the same rights as everybody else had. He didn't have the right to the phone call or medical or visitation or proper eating. So it's really sad that the system shut itself down so bad at this time in need.
And Kathy, your feelings today after having gone through this experience, from your husband being considered an American hero for so many to being called a terrorist and being imprisoned, that's 5 years ago, this is today. How do you feel?
Well, we don't feel that he's actually a hero. We just feel that he's a man who was at the right place at the right time, who did the right thing. As far as what happened to him, it's very disappointing and it's very sad, you know? But, you know, things happen and God willing, people learn from them. And hopefully these mistakes won't happen again.
Are you suing?
We are. From the beginning. Because I was so angry. I can't describe the feelings that I had. And again, I thought it was revenge that I wanted, but it really wasn't revenge. It was justice. But I think we're at peace with it now. I think I'm not angry anymore about it. And we still don't know what's going to happen with the lawsuit anyway. I know they threw it out one time and it was brought back in. I mean, they could still throw it out. Who knows? Yeah, we don't know what's going to happen with it. It's just sitting there, just like my husband did.
Well, the main reason the story got out because of a lawyer, because he wanted her to put everything in paper.
And what do you hope to accomplish with the lawsuit?
Well, I think some things have already been accomplished, thank God. I think they learned their mistakes from Katrina. I saw that with Gustav. They did things a lot differently, actually. I would hope that they wouldn't stereotype as bad. I think there was a lot of stereotyping, intentionally or not. Unfortunately, it did happen. And I say this because my husband was at this house, our house, and he was arrested, and our neighbor across the street, who was at his house, he was picked up and sent to a different place wherever he wanted to go. So, unfortunately, there was a lot of stereotyping, and I hope that they learned their lessons, at least from this story, that, you know, don't judge somebody just by appearance.
Finally, Zaytoun, has it shaken your faith in America?
Okay. Not, I mean, the life, I think, moving to forehead, because now the life getting better. Now we see a lot of improvement in the city, and the children. I mean, for me, I like myself. I like to forget all about it, and I like keep look for in the future to with a smile. Because I mean, the past doesn't take us anywhere. We should just go ahead, focus about rebuild, do right things, and build relationship with everybody else. Especially with we have a lot of new people in the city, and we have some, I mean, most of the original people back. We have, like now in my neighborhood, we have plenty of new neighbors, and we have the original neighbors. We back together, and everything going back close to normal.
Abdulrahman and Kathy Zaytoun speaking to us from New Orleans. When we come back from break, we'll return to Dave Eggers, the celebrated writer who chronicled their story in his latest book, Zaytoun. It just won the American Book Award. Stay with us. Germaine, Saint-Germain. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 850 stations on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish for any radio station to take. As we return now to our global broadcast exclusive, we go back now to writer Dave Eggers, whose nonfiction work, Zaytun, tells the story of Abdulrahman and Kathy Zaytun in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina 5 years ago. Zaytun going from American hero to terrorist in the eyes of the U.S. authorities. I spoke to Eggers Thursday and asked him to describe the conditions under which Abdulrahman Zaytun was held when he was arrested in New Orleans in the aftermath of the storm.
The prison had been erected by trustees of Angola, and the guards were manning it, along with it being a home base for a lot of National Guardsmen. And so once they were handed off, that was the last the arresting officers saw of them. And then they were in the hands of this whole other body that took a look at our assumption is that they took a look at the last names and origins of Nasser and Zaytun in particular and thought, huh, we might have something really interesting on our hands. And so that's when they were visited by Homeland Security representatives, and that's when they had a very strange circumstance where another man was put in their cage and sort of in an attempt, Zaytun believes, to get them talking, would try to provoke them with anti-American rhetoric. It was very strange. And but I think that this, again, this successive nature of handing them off from one body to the next, and once they were put on a bus and sent to Hunt Correctional Facility, then they were lost even deeper in the system. No one was really tracking them and others because very good record keeping was not being kept, and they weren't subject to the same rights of prisoners at Hunt who had been processed adequately. And so, and I think that, you know, you take a lot of National Guardsmen, many of whom, and military personnel, many of whom had been in Iraq and Afghanistan, and many of whom were believing the hype that this city was out of control and that they were entering a war zone. And it's no wonder that they would say to Zaytun and Nasser, you guys are al-Qaeda, you guys are Taliban, and suspect them. And I think that that climate right then was very troubling. And so it led to this military solution to a humanitarian problem. And I think that there was a paranoia in the air that didn't serve anybody very well. And Ralph Gonzalez, one of the arresting officers from New Mexico, told me, he said he had been led to believe that they were entering a war zone and that what they were sent there to do, fully armed with machine guns and body armor and, you know, armed to the teeth, was an operation for command and control. But what they found within hours of landing in the city was that they were needed mostly for search and rescue. And so I think that as much as so many agencies tried to do their best, I think that the climate and the misinformation and the misplaced priorities led to some very unfortunate results.
Zaytun got very sick in the jail and in the prison.
Yeah, you know, first he had, you know, a very bad cut on his foot in that he was getting infected while he was at Camp Greyhound. And here's a guy, he's old school, he's incredibly resilient, he's not one to complain about an injury, but he couldn't get help. Doctors would go to and fro, and they wouldn't stop to help him. And then once he was at Hunt, he couldn't get any help at all, and he felt like he had an incredible pain in his side that was eating away at him, and he didn't know what it was. And so, but of course, he got no medical attention there. And, you know, again, he was left there to think because nothing was improving. He had no reason to believe that he might ever be released. If you haven't gotten adequate legal representation and you're not able to contact your family, what reason does he have to believe that he will ever get out? And I think a lot of the prisoners that did Katrina time were in that same circumstance where none of the rights that we expect were there, and it turned into a Kafkaesque situation.
Dave Eggers, when Kathy finally learned that he was alive and then started to make calls and even had a lawyer and even knew he was at Hunt but told he wasn't, how long was that time from when he had been picked up September 6th to when he was finally released?
It was 3 weeks before she heard from him. That was when the missionary who Zaytoun had given his phone number to called Kathy. And that's when she first knew that he was even alive. And what was interesting was that even then, it was extremely difficult to extract him from Hunt. And it was only because they had means to hire a private lawyer. They had a property that they could put up against the bail, and because they had set bail for all of those charged after Katrina with minor offenses, looting or you know, stealing a sausage in one case. The bail was astronomical, in some cases $100,000 for stealing a small piece of food. And so this was the case with Zaytoun, too. The bail was I think, about $100,000. And so they had to put up their office building as collateral to get him out. And even then, when there was a court hearing finally set, Kathy wasn't told where it was, couldn't find where the courthouse was, where they were holding these hearings. And when she called to find out, they told her that she couldn't be told where the court hearing would be, that was, quote-unquote, private information. And it's interesting that what Kathy says is that after all of this and all that she went through, it was that moment that really broke her, is that she knew that her husband was alive finally, and all she wanted to do was reach him and be able to see him again. And that's when, even then, the bureaucracy and this sort of humanity and this callousness sort of prevented her from doing so, and that they wouldn't even tell her where he was, you know, where the trial would be held. And so I think, you know, I do hope that everybody learned something from this, but I think it's a lesson in how this sort of everyday inhumanity or everyday, you know, what might seem like small abuses of power or the lack of recognition of our common humanity can cause incredible suffering.
How is it that Todd Gambino and Nasser ended up in prison for so many more months, up to, in Todd's case, a year?
They didn't have the—they and hundreds of others didn't have the money to hire private lawyers. And without that, you didn't have a prayer. There are a lot of really great public defenders who took it upon themselves to search out these prisoners who were lost in the system, and to try to track them and find out what they were charged with and give them representation. But that took many, many months to sort out. And the Zaytouns did what they could for their friends, but it was, you know, there's only so much that you can do. And there were so many others that were in the same situation. So. You know, Todd is out now, and he's doing fine. He's actually working in a shallow oil rig off the Gulf, just work that he had done before. And Nasser went back to Syria. It's a shame, but there are hundreds of other stories like it.
And now the lawsuit to, as Kathy said, to bring some kind of justice to stop this from happening again.
Well, what one lawyer said was that they had better get in line. There are thousands of civil suits against the city, the state, FEMA, Homeland Security, government, and there isn't a whole lot of movement with any of these civil suits. The most famous among them is the case of the two men who were shot on the Danziger Bridge, and the officers who are being held responsible for that. Obviously, that case is moving forward on both levels, on a criminal level, on a civil level. But I don't think, I'm not holding my breath that the rest of these civil cases are going to result in compensation or any sort of, satisfaction anytime soon. I think that the Zaytuns have put it behind them, and I think that telling their story created, I think, a sense of peace and closure, if you will, and also the fact that, they helped create the Zaytun Foundation, which has been able to give grants to a number of nonprofits all over New Orleans that, like themselves, they're helping rebuild the city, and I think that that gives them some sense of wholeness, too. And so, but the civil suit, I think we could find ourselves 10 years from now saying at the same, and it would not have moved a great deal. But I know that Kathy and especially wanted to do it as a gesture just to make sure that this wasn't forgotten.
Dave Eggers, you certainly will ensure that this story is not only not forgotten, but is learned about, is read all over the world, both with Zaytun and also with Voice of Witness. I'm wondering, as we conclude, we'll lose the satellite in a minute, how you fit the story of Zaytun, of the Zaytuns, into all your Voice of Witness series. Underground America, Narratives of Undocumented Lives, Surviving Justice, America's Wrongfully Convicted and Exonerated, Out of Exile, Narratives from the Abducted and Displaced People of Sudan, and, of course, what we're talking about today on this fifth anniversary, Voices from the Storm, the People of New Orleans and Hurricane Katrina and its aftermath.
I just believe in the right of people, and I think the need for people to be able to be heard. I think that what we found with Voice of Witness is, again and again, when you give the opportunity to people to tell their story from beginning to end, we ask them, where were you born? What were you like as a child? Who were your friends? What was your family like? What was your home life like? We go all the way from birth to where they are now. And I think that when you give people control over their story a bit and you give them a sense of ownership over their story and that we're not going to publish it until you've approved of every word and make sure that it's completely accurate and that we fact-checked it independently, I think that again and again you find people that have been victimized and who have, suffered a good deal when finally they can get their story on paper, on the record, completely right. I think that there's an incredible sense of relief that comes to them. That's what our narrators tell us again and again. It's like finally this burden that they've felt for so long, this story that they've carried around, is finally out there. And maybe those who are responsible for this might be less likely to do it again, or the system that's responsible might be closer to being corrected or addressed because that they spoke up.
Dave Eggers, author of Zaytun. It just won the American Book Award. He's also founder of the independent publishing house and literary journal McSweeney's. The book's being adapted into an animated movie directed by Jonathan Demme next year. On Monday, we'll continue in New Orleans to mark the fifth anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, who took producer, Armante, Angela Kama, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Masood, and Robbie Karen. And a very fond farewell today to Samantha Chambly. For 5 years, she's brightened up Democracy Now! With her warmth, her dedication, her compassion, intelligence. Sam, we wish you the very best as you move on to film school. I can't wait to watch your first films and say, play it again, Sam. Thank you so much, Sam. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.